Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
Welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World. I'm Barry Strauss, and I'm really pleased to speak to you today and to be able to talk to you about the fascinating subject of Caesar's funeral. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man. So are they all honorable men. Come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. Well, those words need no introduction. They're from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and they're the famous beginning of the speech that Mark Antony gave at the funeral of his friend and comrade Julius Caesar. The reality is that Mark Antony never said those words. But, just as Shakespeare has it, the funeral was a turning point. Only the real funeral of Julius Caesar was even juicier and more spectacular than the version that Shakespeare gives us. And so what I'd like to talk to you about today is the real version. So, as you know, Caesar was assassinated on the 15th of March, 44 BC, the Ides of March. The funeral took place on the 20th of March. What happened in between? Because what happened in between is a very important part of the story. So, after the assassination, the assassins, accompanied by the security force of gladiators that Decimus Brutus had given them, the assassins marched through the streets of Rome, brandishing their bloody daggers, and they went up to the Capitoline Hill, where they found security in a perimeter that was guarded by their gladiators. And they negotiated with the other authorities in Rome, in particular with Caesar's supporters. Now, on the 17th of March, they won a great victory. The Senate agreed to amnesty for the assassin. The assassins would pay no price for murdering the dictator of Rome. This was a great victory for the assassins, and they were able to march down from the Capitoline Hill and go home. They even had dinner. They had reconciliation dinners with two of Caesar's great supporters, Mark Antony and Marcus Lepidus. That, however, was not the end of the story, because in other ways, things hadn't gone so well for the assassins. The day before, for instance, Marcus Brutus, the great Brutus, gave a public address from the Capitoline Hill. He came down a little bit. He spoke to the crowd, including Caesar's veteran soldiers who were pouring into the city after the assassination of their chief. And Brutus told them that they had nothing to worry about, that they would be able to keep the lands and the bonuses that Caesar had given them. Now, that was good news in a way for those soldiers, but it wasn't really what they wanted to hear. What they wanted to hear from Brutus was that he was going to up the ante and give them a raise, that he was going to give them even more of a bonus than Caesar had given them. And to those soldiers, it would have looked as if Brutus was kind of cheap. And they would have wondered, can we really trust this guy? Is this guy going to support us? Brutus was showing his lack of political sense by not making a deal with Caesar's soldiers. In a real sense, they were the center of gravity in Roman politics. Well, as if that weren't bad enough, on the 18th of March, Brutus caved in again. He supported a motion in the Senate to allow Caesar to have a public funeral and for his Caesar's will to be read in public. Mark Antony, Caesar's right-hand man, had strongly supported this. Cassius, Brutus's comrade-in-arms among the assassins, had been completely against. Cassius worried that if Caesar had a public funeral, this would turn into an occasion for Caesar's supporters to rally and to turn on the assassins. Why did Brutus give in? Well, we don't know, but probably because he felt he had no alternative. He felt that the support for a funeral was just too great, and if he hadn't given in, then Caesar's veterans would have forced the issue violently. And so the Senate agreed to a public funeral. Now, funerals of politicians in Rome were always big, and they were often spectacular, but they were almost always private. For Caesar to get a public funeral put on by the Roman state was rare and quite a concession. That was the 18th of March. On the 19th of March, Caesar's will was read in Mark Antony's house, a grand mansion near the Roman Forum. Antony must have been disappointed because he was largely left out of Caesar's will. We'll talk later about who exactly was in Caesar's will, but one of the great beneficiaries was the Roman public. Caesar left every Roman citizen a small but significant bonus, and Caesar also announced that his villa, Caesar's gardens, about a mile away from the Roman Forum on the other side of the Tiber River, would be turned into a public park. It was as if, even from beyond the grave, Caesar was showing that he was still a very clever populist politician, and he knew how to reach out to the Roman people. This was not good news for the assassins, who would have preferred that Caesar look like a villain to the Roman people. Now he looked like anything but. However, for Mark Antony, Caesar's ally, this was not entirely good news. There really wasn't anything in the will for him. There wasn't anything in the will that would advance his political career. For Mark Antony, the big way to grasp the future was to use the funeral. Antony would be a key player in the funeral for two reasons. First, because he was one of the two consuls of the year in Rome, and the two consuls were the chief executive officers in Rome. Second, because he was given the right to give the funeral oration, which would be a key moment. And as we'll see, Antony left nothing to chance. He planned the funeral very carefully as an event that would highlight not only Caesar, but also Mark Antony. Interesting to speculate that two women played a role in Antony's careful preparations for the funeral. We'll talk about the second woman in a moment, but the first woman was his wife, Fulvia. Fulvia was a veteran of Roman politics. She'd been widowed twice before she married Antony. Both of her previous husbands had been prominent politicians. Her first husband had been assassinated several years earlier. He had a funeral, a very dramatic funeral. It was a private funeral, but it ended up as a soapbox for his political position, and it ended up with a riot that was memorable for the damage it did and memorable for the way it advanced his political movement. And this was the woman who was married to Antony. So if there was anyone who could give Antony advice on how to exploit a funeral, it was his wife, Fulvia. Now, just a bit of background. The funerals of Roman nobles always were shows. The classic elements were the body lying in state, a funeral procession carrying the body to the Roman Forum, a family member or professional actor dressed in a beeswax mask and costume to represent the deceased, while others in the procession wore beeswax masks of famous ancestors of the deceased. A funeral oration delivered from the speaker's platform. The burial itself, cremation in Roman practice, and a banquet. Now, Caesar's spectacular funeral had all this and more. It combined music, acting, a procession, a chorus, a funeral pyre to rival a Gallic chieftain's, and finally, a mechanical marvel. Before Caesar's funeral began, the organizers set up a gilded shrine on the speaker's platform. The shrine was modeled to look like the temple of Mother Venus, and in it, the corpse would be held. Now, the temple of Mother Venus had been built. It was just being finished at this time. It had been built at Caesar's initiative and at Caesar's expense. It was part of the new forum of Julius Caesar that Caesar had built adjacent to the Roman forum. And it was a way, of course, of advertising Caesar's achievements. Venus was considered to be Caesar's ancestor and also the ancestral goddess of the Roman people. So this temple, this shrine, this gilded shrine was on the speaker's platform. The organizers did not plan to cremate Caesar's body there, however. They set up a funeral pyre about a half a mile away outside the walls of the city in the area known as the Field of Mars. Now, on the day of the 20th itself, the funeral procession began not far away from the forum, probably began outside the public mansion, the house that was Caesar's official residence adjacent to the forum. It's where Caesar lived in his capacity as the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest of Rome. Musicians and actors took part in the procession, as well as men carrying busts of Caesar's. But a key player or players was the actor who was wearing a beeswax mask of Caesar and dressed in a triumphal robe. There would certainly have been one actor that was standard for the funeral of a Roman noble. There might have been as many as five actors, one for each of Caesar's triumphs. As usual, the actor or actors was or were trained to imitate the deceased's pace and bearing. Now, these beeswax masks, they were life masks made while the person was still alive. So this actor or actors who imitated the way Caesar walked and the way he held himself and wearing a life mask gave an uncanny impression of the dead man come back to life. As the corpse was carried in the procession, it was accompanied by torchbearers and freedmen, ex-slaves who'd been freed by Caesar's will. They walked beside it. Public officials carried Caesar's corpse on an ivory couch covered with purple and gold. Normally, the corpse was visible, but Caesar's, because of the terrible condition of his wounded body, was covered, and only a wax image represented the deceased. Leading the procession was Caesar's father-in-law, Cornelius Piso, a formal consul. He led the body into the forum. Meanwhile, Caesar's veterans ran to escort it as a kind of bodyguard. The body was placed in the gilded shrine on the speaker's platform. Beside it, a spear held up the toga that Caesar wore on the day he was murdered. We must imagine thousands of people in the Roman Forum watching the event. There would be women among them. Women attended Roman funerals, and Caesar's wife, Calpurnia, was surely there. There was wailing, there were laments, there was a clashing of shields, and then came the dramatic moment of Antony's speech. The truth is, we don't know what he said. Cicero, speaking a few months later, said that Antony gave a rabble-rousing speech. But Cicero hated Antony, and we can't trust what he said. Another historian, writing two centuries later, says that Antony merely had a herald read Caesar's decrees, in which the senators gave Caesar divine honors and promised to defend his safety. That would have been ironic indeed. Romans loved irony, but it sounds a little too good to be true. And me, I have to agree with Cicero that Antony gave a speech. What did he say? Well, we don't know. Another historian writing about 200 years later gives a version, and ancient historians, when they gave speeches, they didn't give you transcripts of what people said. They told you what they think they should have said. So in this version, Antony went through a list of Caesar's achievements, his honors, the clemency or mercy that he had shown to the men who fought against him in the Civil War. And then Antony underlined the bitter irony of how such a kind and generous man was murdered in turn. But you know, in a way, it really doesn't matter what Antony did or didn't happen in the speech, because what really mattered was what happened next. Normally, there would be a funeral hymn and a lament, and so there was. But Antony performed an unusual, unprecedented variation of this funeral hymn and lament. He did so by having the crowd join him. He would say a line, and then the crowd would be invited to repeat it after him, all to the sound of a flute. It was a kind of audience participation which was utterly unheard of in a Roman funeral. Then an actor got up. It was an actor impersonating Caesar. We've spoken about the actor in his beeswax mask. This actor named the names of men for whom Caesar had done favors, including the murderers. And then, in an inspired act of sarcasm, he delivered a line from Roman tragedy. Quote, "Did I save them just so they could destroy me? Did I save them just so that they could destroy me?" Imagine the ripple that went through the crowd at this bitter, sarcastic line. But that wasn't all. Now came the final touch. On the speaker's platform, a wax image of Caesar was raised above the body, and it was rotated by a mechanical device so that it showed all the man's wounds, Caesar's 23 wounds, including those on his face. This device was unprecedented, and it was the pièce de résistance which drove the crowd to take action. So let's look at it a little closer. To learn more about the device, I spoke to my friend and colleague Adrian Mayer, a research scholar at Stanford. Adrienne is a National Book Award nominated author, and she now has a terrific new book out called Gods and Robots: Myths, Machines, and Ancient Dreams of Technology. In this book, she offers an astute analysis of Greek and Roman innovations and what they mean for us today. So I asked Adrienne about this mechanical device, this rotating wax image at Caesar's funeral. She pointed out to me that there's a long tradition in the ancient Greek world of creating marvelous mechanical devices and animated statues. As for the wax rotating image of Caesar, the mechanism for making something rise and revolve would have been a relatively simple matter of pulleys, gears, and cams, and it could have been easily constructed for the funeral. Now, conveniently for Antony and the organizers of the funeral, there happened to be an expert on mechanical devices in Rome at the time, or rather somebody who had access to the world's greatest experts on mechanical devices. This person was Cleopatra. Cleopatra was living in the suburbs of Rome in Caesar's garden, Caesar's villa, if you will, Caesar's palace, at the time of the assassination. Cleopatra, queen of Egypt, came from Alexandria. And Alexandria was to mechanical devices what Silicon Valley is to digital technology. It was the center of know-how of mechanical devices. And Cleopatra was also a master of dramatic scenes and theatrical spectacles. Let's speculate that before the funeral, Antony went to Cleopatra, or better yet, that Cleopatra sent a messenger to Antony and said, "You know, if you really want to put on a great show, we can help you put together a mechanical device, an image of Caesar, that will stun the crowd." Now, there was only one downside. As Adrian Mayer points out, mechanical devices in the ancient world had a bad connotation. They were connected to tyrants and tyranny. They seemed to be, to believers in republics and democracies, they seemed to be the sort of thing that only someone who wanted to monopolize power would abuse. There was something dangerous to freedom in them. By using this device, and by making people perhaps think that he got it from Cleopatra, Antony was taking a risk. But I think he had a reason to take this risk. Antony knew that the funeral was going to be his great opportunity, a moment that would not be repeated, a moment for him to rise to the head of the political class. And by having this spectacular device, he could make sure that the occasion went his way. If that's what he was thinking, and I admit that the connection to Cleopatra is pure speculation, if that's what he was thinking, it worked. Because the result of the mechanical device was to push the crowd over the edge. The result was mob action. The crowd went up on the speaker's platform, they took Caesar's bier, and they carried it on their shoulders. They ignored the plan to cremate him in the field of Mars. Instead, they decided to try to cremate him in the nearby Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill, or in the nearby Senate House. But there were soldiers there to provide security, and they prevented the crowd from doing either of those two things. Instead, they took the bier into the Roman Forum. They threw together a pyre of dry branches, they took benches from the nearby law courts, and they cremated Caesar there on the Roman Forum, rather than taking him, as was planned, to the field of Mars. As they did so, Caesar's supporters and mourners threw jewelry, gold, weapons into the fire as a way of showing their last respects to the fallen dictators. Afterwards, they said that the crowd wasn't acting on its own, but rather they were directed by two beings, two magical beings bearing swords. Some people even said that these were the twin gods, Castor and Pollux. Was this a rumor, people's imagination? Was it a way of justifying the riot after the facts? Or were these so-called twin gods agents provocateurs? We don't know. We can only speculate. After the mob action and after the impromptu funeral pyre and the burning of the body, followed a riot. And this, one suspects, was organized in advance. The rioters poured out of the forum and they attacked the homes of Caesar's assassins. Fortunately for those assassins, many of those homes were heavily guarded. The rioters then went after a target of opportunity. They went after a man named Cinna, who they thought was Caesar's opponent, Cornelius Cinna. They got the wrong Cinna. They went after Helvidius Cinna, who was Caesar's supporter and a poet as well as a politician. They killed and decapitated the wrong Cinna and paraded his head through the streets. While Rome finally calmed down, and the upshot of Caesar's funeral to remember was much as Shakespeare has it in his play. The upshot was that the assassins went into hiding. The assassins had lost the opportunity to turn public opinion around to support them, to think of Caesar as a would-be tyrant. and they lost the opportunity to turn this into an occasion to restore the Republic. Antony's star went up. Not long afterwards, the assassins had to leave Rome. So Antony could have been well satisfied with the results of Caesar's funeral. He was not, however, the biggest winner. The biggest winner of Caesar's funeral was a man who was not even there at the time. The biggest winner was Julius Caesar's grandnephew, Gaius Octavius. He was not in Rome. Rather, he was across the Adriatic Sea in what is today Albania, in a Roman military base where Caesar had sent him to work with the troops and to learn the family business, as it were, because Gaius Octavius was only 18 years old. He was the grandson of Caesar's sister. Caesar himself had no living, legitimate Roman children at the time. His daughter Julia had died. His illegitimate son, Caesarion, was Egyptian, not Roman. And so he turned to his grandnephew, Gaius Octavius. In his will, Caesar left three-quarters of his fortune, his huge fortune, to Gaius Octavius. Not only that, he gave Gaius Octavius his name. The will named Octavius to be posthumously adopted by Caesar and to be entitled to the name of Gaius Julius Caesar. Now, the Romans generally practiced adult adoption. It was not unusual for an adult like Caesar to adopt an 18-year-old like Gaius Octavius. It was extremely unusual to engage in posthumous adoption. That's not something that the Romans usually did. At the time, Antony was not all that worried. He thought of Octavius as a kid, and he thought he could brush the kid aside. But he was wrong. Caesar did not choose Octavius by chance or merely because he was a close relative. Caesar had been watching Octavius for years, and he had been grooming him, and he'd been impressed by the young man, and he realized that Octavius had the family talent. He was young, but he was a man to reckon with. He had that magical political instinct. He was violent, ambitious, ruthless, and he knew how to manipulate people. And so in choosing Octavius, Caesar had chosen very, very wisely. And if Antony thought that he could control Octavius and turn the situation to his advantage, he was sadly mistaken. Well, the results are a long story. And you can read about the results, and you can read about that story. You can read about what happened to Antony and Octavius in my new book, 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors from Augustus to Constantine. This book will be available on March 5th, wherever books are sold. And I promise you, it takes the story from after Caesar's assassination, through the career of Octavius, and through the career of the Roman Empire that he founds, because Gaius Octavius was none other than the man who would one day become Augustus, the first Roman emperor. But that's another story. For now, thank you for listening to Season 2 of Antiquitas. Stay tuned for information about Season 3. I'm Barry Strauss, and I'll speak to you soon.
Theme music by Lush Life.